The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to We the People with Aaron Ryan.
Beau Cundiff.
Bob Martin.
And Ray Halp, our guest.
Thank you.
Who will ultimately speak. We just sort of ran in the door, so it's like, here, throw these headphones on and we're going to do a show. Oh my gosh. So today, we're going to talk about...
Well, I thought we'd talk about public lands in general, maybe from the beginning to present, and what's not working as intended.
Yeah, I think everybody knows the part about not working, but I think they would be interested to know how we got to not working.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes it's not exactly what everybody thinks. And sometimes the fix isn't what we think either.
That's true.
So it's worth digging in a little bit. Bill's manning the chat room. He's not allowed to talk while he types.
I'm not good at multitasking.
He's over here. He's all.
I'm guilty. I think the forest hasn't been managed correctly for a long time. I think we can all pretty much agree to that. And it's really a mess right now. When you go up and, you know, you drive through the woods today, it's a marked difference between Forest Service land and private land. Just look at the ground. I mean, you can tell just by looking at it.
Yeah, it's a mess.
What's what?
Yeah, a lot of the forested land is at risk if you're next to National Forest right now.
Yeah, that's true. If you have property that adjoins,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
welcome to the next catastrophic fire.
Exactly. You're parked next to a firebomb. Yeah,
or beetle impact or something.
Yep. Some other horrible thing.
Yeah, let's talk about that, too, because I've been seeing quite a bit of that lately, and I'm kind of curious what's happening
there.
Sure. So
give people your background so that they know we're not just, see, Bill and I will be just making things up. Ray will actually be a delivering fact. We're just here for the comic relief.
Well, the bulk of my career has been working mostly on the West Coast. I spent a little bit of time on the East Coast. I retired in 2010 from the U.S. Forest Service. I was a district ranger when I retired. Prior to that, the first two-thirds of my career was as a forester. And, after that, I decided to, do something different because National Forests were going in a different direction than what I grew up to believe. And, we were just kind of losing it and losing the public focus.
So you started when? 80-something?
No, I started in 1976.
Oh, 70-something.
Yeah.
And you were what? Was that your beginning career? Were you a 20-something at that point?
I was 22, I think. 21, 22 years
so
old.
So you really did do that your whole,
yeah,
like your whole
professional
career? Well,
I was in private doing things before that. Not private forestry, but retail and those
kind
of things.
All the stuff we all do.
Yeah, all the stuff to get through school.
Can you really tell? I mean, when you look at the forest today versus when you first got started, I mean, and can you tell the difference?
Oh, dramatically different. And that's the thing that most people don't understand is that, when some of us who've been around that long and have worked off and on in the same place, in the early part of my career, I was working, putting the roads in, developing the forest for harvest, that kind of thing, and doing a lot of assessment work of really what was out there in a lot of the forested land that really hadn't had a lot of people walking on it before.
And you were making it accessible.
Yeah.
Unlike now,
yeah,
where we're making it unaccessible.
Yeah, doing all the data collection and that kind of thing, inventories.
Sure.
And I can tell you from personal experience, it's just dramatically different today, mm-hmm, than it was then.
Interesting. And now, you retired as the district ranger.
As a district ranger, yeah.
In the area where now you're the county supervisor.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's kind of a fun viewpoint, I guess.
Well,
and you live,
yeah,
there, too. So.
Yeah, I do. Well, it's kind of a natural progression. I mean, some people kind of think that politics and ranger are kind of different, but they're really the same. You work with the same communities, same issues, mm-hmm, those kind of things. And I couldn't stand sitting around and not using the talent I had for the community.
Well, besides, everybody kept, mm-hmm, calling. Hey, what's he's my go-to guy. What does this mean? What are they talking about?
Yeah. Well, so, I taught for 4 years at the community college that College
of Siskiyous.
Oh, that's
right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and we, you know, we had a pretty good forestry program going there for a little bit of time. Then, of course, like all grants, you know, they end, and so did the program.
Oh.
You know, and so, you know, I did a little bit of consulting on the side as an RPF and wrote some, I guess some position papers, I guess, for counties, Modoc County for sage grouse and some of the other habitat things they were confronted with. And then just seemed natural that get engaged. And, you know, politics kind of got us into this. And science isn't going to get us out. And I think politics is going to get us back, hopefully, to some kind of...
As long as everybody doesn't just throw up their hands and walk away.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that's not one of the choices at this point is, it's too hard, it's too far gone, there's nothing we can do, throw in the towel and walk away.
Well, and that's part of the part of the American consciousness. And, you know, just like history and any other thing, the reason I wanted to come in and talk today is that I really don't think most people understand... the relationship between counties and their public lands, and how we got to this point, and what was the design? Believe it or not, there was kind of a master design.
There was
design
a plan. Oh my
in
gosh!
All this, not the current mess we see ourselves in.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
How about 1890?
Okay. I'm like,
let's go to the beginning.
Hold on. Last night we watched How the West Was Won. Was that the Debbie Reynolds era?
Well, it's really important. If you look back at that time, there was a lot of same kind of turmoil about what to do with natural resources going on in our Congress. And it was a debate between Gifford Pinchot and John Muir at the time.
Oh.
And between the two of them, they couldn't come to grips with what public land should be. You know, should it be hands off, which was John Muir, or should it be wise use, which was Gifford Pinchot? So in a conference in 1890, the two parties thought they struck a reasonable compromise, and the Park Service was actually formed for the preservation of lands under John Muir's philosophy. And Gifford Pinchot led the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it was formed for preservation, but it was initially run by a guy who thought we should use it.
Yes, yes. And, you know, Gifford Pinchot at the time actually brought forestry to the United States. Prior to that, it was only being practiced in Europe. And he formed the Yale Forestry School. And as such, started modern forestry and forest science in the United States. But part of that, which is really important, is the Forest Service is the only agency that's been concocted that I'm aware of in the federal government that actually has a research branch to support the work that it does.
Really?
And that was from the very beginning, yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Where are they? Back in Washington?
Actually, they're scattered all over the country. There's one right here in Redding.
Really?
Yeah.
What are they called?
Pacific Northwest Research Station.
And that's a Forest Service thing?
That's a Forest Service station, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so back in the day when you first got started,
mm-hmm.
my guess is they were a lot more active? Or had a lot more say, maybe?
Well, the laws were clearer. I'll put it that way. And the agency enjoyed a great deal of public trust and support at that point in time, and you know, the agency was practicing some fairly reasonable forestry in the 60s and 70s, though it had not embraced yet the new science of forest ecology. And that was kind of a transitional period in the 70s into the 80s with all of the various acts that everybody hears about, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act and the National Environmental Policy Act of the early 70s that came into being. Also really important at that point in time was that nobody really knew too much about what the government was doing. And as a result of that, I kind of theorized the suspicions of the 60s. The National Environmental Policy Act was put into place to publicly disclose, not to conduct science experiments like it is today, but to publicly disclose what the government was actually doing with their projects.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be nice to know.
Yeah, it was a public disclosure law, not a massive scientific undertaking.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so who wrote it and what happened to it?
Well, it was hijacked by the courts pretty quickly, and the emphasis
changed. Should have seen that one coming.
Yeah, I can see. You know, in my early years, The environmental assessment took us about 3 months to complete. They were maybe 25 pages at the most, which was the intent. And today we see them taking 2 years and often 600 pages, and something that was fairly minimal cost is now into the millions. The same magnitude of what we were doing, and is actually much less.
And what do you count the increased cost to? I mean, is it just more bureaucracy,
more layers, more layers of trying to protect against lawsuit?
Right.
Yeah, that's a big topic today.
So
lawsuit
nothing's
thing.
Going into land development or preservation. It's all going into administrative.
Sure. Well, they all want wilderness area. I do know that because they're constantly hitting up the congressional districts. You know, well, we don't have enough wilderness area.
Yeah.
And there's quite a push there now.
But I have to go back to the original premise.
You hold know, that thought.
That we first
hold the original premise.
I'll do that.
In conjunction with the whole beginning of our day here, we're 5 minutes late for our break.
It's going to put us back on track. We'll be heroes.
This isn't good. Bob, you're going to have to flag me. All righty. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with Ray Haupt. We're talking about the Forest Service history, sort of, and how we got to where we are with our public lands. We're talking about public lands. Yeah, that's better than Forest Service.
Yeah.
And Bill's here, too.
Yeah.
And Bob. We'll be right back. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What should we do about them? What do they want? What should we do about them? What do they want?
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You're going to make us laugh, aren't you, Bob?
Got to try.
Yeah, what a great topic for all of this. So we're speaking with Ray Haupt this morning on forest lands and what's going on with those. And actually, we'll talk about monuments, too. We were talking about that on the break. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The chat room is alive and well. Hello to everybody in there. And, okay, so... So, fast forward to the monument thing. They just designated one where in Mendocino, on the Mendocino Forest.
Right.
Just so happens it's where all the major pot growing is happening.
Yeah, and a lot of other activity on that landscape. But
so now that it's a monument,
yes,
that means nobody gets to go on it.
Well, there'll be a monument. Management plan put in place, so to speak. Some of them, you know, they vary. They vary from near wilderness to a lot of recreation kind of things. One of the ones that the Clinton administration did in the sequoia for the preservation of the giant sequoia trees is actively managed, just not allowed to produce a commercial product anymore.
What's the difference between a wilderness designation and a monument designation?
Well, wilderness is designated by Congress, so there is a vote on it, and it is reserved and set aside. The first Wilderness Act was 1964 in the Wilderness Act, and that was it kind of rolled a lot of lands in from 1935 primitive designation that was in place at that time. Largely lands that were pristine and needed to be held in higher protection, so to speak, not just kind of general landscape.
So no mechanized anything in a wilderness area?
Not unless it was historically part of the operation of that part of the land. So you will find some wilderness that allow mechanization to a limited degree.
But that's also true for a monument, correct?
A monument can be just about anything that goes into the monument plan.
Oh, okay. So each one can be different.
Yeah, the difference is that Congress designates what's allowed and what's not allowed under wilderness management, but the executive branch solely does the monument piece.
Which makes it not part of the people's will.
No, which makes it sort of it just drops on the landscape and then you're stuck with it.
And it preempts what we were talking about earlier with the whole development period or early on in the United States was predicated on these public domain lands being productive. And they were to be productive for the rural economy and also for the tax base because, of course, counties cannot tax public lands. And so the portion of the receipts that come off those lands were to supply the tax revenues for roads and schools in support of rural California as well as the rural West.
All right, so you were talking about, tell folks what you were telling us during the break. We shouldn't talk during the break because what happens is then we don't actually talk about it on the air. Like, oh, yeah, we already talked about that. Okay, so how we have swung politically and why.
Well, it's kind of interesting, you know, sitting in the agency and watching the different administrations come and go. The agency was largely disconnected politically, at least at the field level, until really the Reagan administration. And but Reagan was faced with a lot of the same issues we face today with unemployment and expanding deficits and those kinds of things, crashed economy. And rather than borrow money, the Reagan administration chose to increase the harvest on public lands to pay off the debt.
What a novel idea.
Yeah.
Because they are a resource.
Yeah. A lot of us, including myself, didn't think that was too smart, you know, to the extent that he did that. We went into something called departure, which means we were cutting above what the growth was on national forest for a short period of time. That's okay as long as you back it down after that. That gets at the heart of what is sustained yield and those kinds of things off those lands. But as a reversal of that, the Clinton administration came in and put a lot of things in place that pretty much nullified began to nullify the active management on public lands. And that hasn't reversed itself. And those swings have taken place over the history, the 100-year-plus history of the agency's you know, historically.
So that's where the management part of it started to kind of slip a little bit, and we started getting the fuels build up and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's when we had a lot of litigation begin. There was litigation before, but not near the intensity.
From the environmental groups?
Environmental groups, you know, industry once in a while, but mostly environmental groups.
When did they start getting paid to sue?
That's an interesting dance because Reagan actually Equal Access to Justice Act, yes, but it had a sunset date on it, and it was limited. It was initially for, as my understanding is, for small business to be able to address their grievances against a very large bureaucracies at the time,
which is a good idea.
Yeah,
like all things that have been abused, started out as a good idea.
Yeah, started out as a good idea. It sunsetted.
When was that? When did it sunset?
It had a 5-year life expectancy. The late 80s, I'm not sure exactly the date. It sunsetted the first time, and then it was picked up by the first Bush administration and reauthorized for, I believe, about a 2-year period.
And what was their thought behind it? Same idea?
Same idea.
Okay.
Same idea, some things going on that people couldn't afford to address their government over issues they were having. And a lot of this was not Forest Service kind of things. These were small business association things and,
sure.
You know, regarding, you know, business enterprise and those kinds of things. And then
the environmental guys were like, hey.
Yeah, well, Bill Clinton then reauthorized it. And I guess it's, I don't know, with an executive order, I guess it's permanent now. But expanded it greatly to include non-governmental organizations,
right.
and others. And you'll see in 19, if you look at the records, you'll see a dramatic increase in litigation beginning about 1993-1994.
Interesting. And so once that started, once the environmental group, and so for people who say live in an area that doesn't have forest or they haven't been involved in that,
uh-huh.
Why would environmental groups sue the forest?
Well, because they're repaid for doing that. And you know, all of us.
But what's the premise of their suit?
Well, even for, I mean, we have the term environmentalist. I like to say the conflict industry mainly because there
sounds so much nicer than enviro-Nazi.
Well, there is an industry around sue and settle and, mm-hmm. and sue for money and sue for profit and that kind of thing.
So that gives you more money to sue for other things.
Yeah, and I'd like to think that this is only from environmental groups, but it's not. You know, I mean, this is government wide. So each bureaucracy has their own ambulance chaser.
Sure, well, look what happened with ADA, right?
Yeah.
You have the guy out there measuring, oh, you're a quarter of an inch off on your ramp, you know.
Sure.
Take them to the cleaners. Well, these guys initially started going after the Forest Service. I mean, now I know what they go after them for. Mm-hmm. You have a huge fire, and they want to cut some of the down, you know, the dead and dying timber or what's still left on the landscape. They want to harvest some of that while it's usable, and they sue them for that to mm-hmm. stop those projects.
Sure.
Back in the day, what were they suing them for?
Well, when it first started, I was personally dealing with some groups that were anti-commercial activity on public lands.
Oh, okay.
And that was their premise. Stop all commercial activity on public lands because, after all, they belong to the public and no one should get a special deal off operating on public lands.
So no harvesting of trees on public land because whoever was doing it, timber company, was making money.
Some timber company makes money off that, yes.
Well, doesn't the money... the timber company makes money, but if it's public lands, the sale of that product goes back into the coffers, correct?
That's right.
Now, what is the current mindset? I mean, why don't they go in and harvest, burn timber? In a lot of cases, they just let it stand until it's too old to harvest, mm-hmm. and then you get bugs, you get everything else, and it makes it very difficult for the forest to really come back and reseed itself. Why don't they go in and clean it up? What's the mindset there?
Well, it's not really a mindset. It's a legal framework. And if you look at the, like I say, since 1993, there's been a lot of precedent set in the administrative record on some of these court cases that increase the process. So constantly the agency is struggling to meet a new legal hurdle that it hadn't anticipated when it started a project. And it's not only legal hurdles against the agency itself, but now have the Endangered Species Act. So there's legal challenges to that agency as well that has to give its concurrence on land activities. And then you have the Council on Environmental Quality out of the President's office who oversees the National
Environmental Policy. So it has to go through all these maneuvers before they can actually go in and start cutting trees by that time.
Yeah.
You know, the government moves so quickly.
lightning speed.
Yeah, lightning speed. Three years later, you have, great, go in and cut all this dead, rotten wood down. And
which is either physically impossible or economically impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Which is crazy.
I know, because you look at how much, I mean, look at the size of some of these fires we're having now, and some of them, granted, are too hot, and there really isn't much to harvest, but a lot of these fires are fast-moving fires, tons of timber still standing there that's harvestable, and it just goes to waste.
Yeah, what concerns me more than anything else is the loss of forested cover.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm not happy personally with looking out my backyard and looking at snags and brush. I'd much rather see trees.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And when they go in and cut that, they replant it.
Well, it's required under law.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had somebody trying to convince me the other day that we go in and we're cutting all the trees down and then we're just left with brush. They don't replant. And then when they do replant, they only plant one species, and so it all... You know, it's not the real forest. I mean, people really don't have
so what's the rule?
Information.
Well, that's an interesting argument. If you were making that argument in 1980, I'd agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're fighting in the forest industry right now. We're fighting the wars of 1970, 1980, thinking that the technology and the research hasn't changed since.
Right. Well, when I came up here in the mid to late 80s, you know, we had the Fountain Fire, which was probably one of the biggest ones we had. That was kind of the beginning of the huge fires. And you go up there now where that's mostly been replanted, and there's a variety of trees in there. And in fact, they're at the age now where they probably going to start thinking about going in and start thinning them out. I mean, it's that.
Yeah, if you look at the progression, I guess, of forestry as a science itself, mm-hmm. You'll see that prior to about 1975, you know, forest ecology didn't exist. And so what the foresters were practicing was something called administrative forestry, which was basically everything reduced to numbers.
Oh.
You know, you can grow this much per acre, and if you do this, you can do that. It was more like a cornfield kind of thing. My class was one of the first classes actually to have forest ecology as part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't make a lot of sense to me when I went to work either. I mean, why would you reforest an area with Douglas fir instead of ponderosa pine when ponderosa pine came off of that
right.
acre? But yet that's what was being done because that was the highest value product with the fastest growth. So and that's all changed.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Well, we have to promise our listeners that we're going to get to the how do we change from a fire industry back to a resource industry? that is the burning question, if you'll pardon the pun.
It is the burning question. There's a lot of money around
and,
that.
And yeah, so we'll talk about that some more when we come back. You're listening to We the People Radio. We are speaking with Ray Haupt, 30 years with the Forest Service, and now he's a county supervisor in the place where he was a district ranger. So we're getting a really nice, plus he doesn't use notes because he remembers everything he ever reads. It's super handy. We brought in the Forest Dictionary, encyclopedia.
If you want to drive a big limousine, I'll buy the longest one you've ever seen. I'll buy you tall, tall trees and all the waters in the seas. I'm a fool, fool, fool for you.
And it's whispered that soon, if we all call the tune, then the piper will lead us to reason. And a new day will dawn for those who stand long, and the forest will echo with laughter.
Instead of crackle with fire. Thanks, Bob.
Hey, it's a break. We were talking about the fountain fire again, and you know, I came up here in the mid late '80s, and at that time, that was like one of the biggest fires we'd had up here, and everybody was really shocked. But
what was that 89, 90? I think it was right when I moved.
Yeah,
I moved.
About 1987. I was gone 3 weeks that year on a fire team.
Yeah.
Well, your response was the Forest Service was started because of
bigger fires.
Yeah, lots bigger fires. Back in the 1700s, 1800s, there were fires that, you know, spanned 10 years and three states.
They burned for 10 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shit.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I guess we're complaining about nothing then.
You know,
sorry.
Well, they were largely unabated, you know, because
we didn't have the crews. We didn't have the resources.
How would you even get there?
Stop them.
Yeah. A lot of it was, you know, undeveloped land and just went on and on and on.
Yikes. So,
and then the fires of 1910 were large fires in the Pacific Northwest you know, the Pulaski incident and all those things at those time, Ranger Pulaski. That's a whole show in itself. But
why would he do or not do?
He held his Ranger district at gunpoint in a mine to protect them from the fire.
Oh, you're kidding me. Well, that's a problem.
Whoopsie.
But he saved their lives, you know.
At gunpoint.
Yeah, at gunpoint.
Ironic.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff out there.
Wow.
Never heard that one.
They did have a lot more local control back then, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, the Pulaski tool is named after him.
I wondered about that. Yeah. I thought that was kind of an interesting coincidence. Okay, yeah. That answered my looming question. Okay, so the Clinton era made tons of changes.
Yes.
All right, give us we were talking on the break, like, you know, give us the, you know, like what?
Where do you want to start?
I don't, well, you know, because the reason I say this is these same players actually are looming for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So if, in fact, we go back to that, for all those people who think that, you know, this is going to be great, what do we have to look forward to? What did your husband do?
Well, I was, you know, I was trained by World War II veterans, basically, who really knew what public service was. So that's where my public service...
Because they were the greatest generation for
reason. And that's where my ethic comes from. The newer generation of folks working for the agency, I don't think really quite understand what they knew and what they imparted on, say, my generation. But there was a call within the agency by that administration at that time that the agency was filled with a bunch of dinosaurs, and they needed to retire. You know, and that was the first call. And there were giants. Hal Salwasser, dean of forestry at OSU, was one of them at that period of time. A whole raft of people left the agency at the time and pretty much drained the corporate memory right out of it. Between about 1993 and about 1997. Along with that, you know, because of the Paperless Reduction Act, 100 years worth of manuals were gotten rid of out of the agency. And they were the corporate knowledge of how to do things.
Exactly. There's your history.
What do you mean they got rid of them?
What worked and
like
what didn't work.
Like they threw them away?
Yeah.
Well, that's super smart.
Well, they knew it all. Yeah. Yeah. That was all.
They knew people who knew everything.
It was old stuff.
It was old technology.
Old stuff. You know, but there was a cookbook on how to do anything in the forest. It was kind of interesting. Some of it was a little antiquated. You had to kind of infiltrate your new science into it and that kind of thing. But the mechanical things,
the
mathematical things, the blueprint was good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. So they get rid of all the old guys. They get rid of all the tried and true stuff.
Yeah.
It's been going on for years and years and years.
And beginning with, my name's the chief after.
It's okay. You could say anybody.
Mike Dombeck.
Okay.
Was actually the first politically appointed chief of the Forest Service. That was visibly, I mean, they've all been political, but the first visible appointee of the agency. You really didn't know, you know, a lot about the nuts and bolts of the agency. Kind of come up on the recreation side of things, and a departure from the we can get it done kind of attitude in the agency. That with that, there were dramatic changes in the National Forest System management at the Washington level. A reversal of a thought process in the past that meant, you know, we serve the public and therefore all the resources should go to the field first. Mm. And that should be always funded first and should be the highest priority to a new paradigm now where the Washington office dramatically grew.
Became an entity of its own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lovely.
And I worked for an old timer who said, today, I've just seen the agency go from public serving to self-serving. And
They took all the budgeting?
And he was probably right, too.
Yeah. Well, the budget began to migrate itself upward. The Office of Management and Budget kept giving the agency unclean bills of health, so to speak, with their budgeting, even though at the field level, I knew every dime that was spent and where it was going.
And so your job back then was to make sure they harvested timber on your area of responsibility, and that was used to do things on your forest,
yes,
right?
And a justification for every dime that was spent. I had spreadsheets to keep track of the public trust funds. We started to migrate then toward something called a unified budget.
Mm.
And
the old one-size-fits-all that never really does.
Yeah. We all of a sudden got clean budgets, but nobody knew where the money was going. And somebody may have. But the authorities to spend money were taken from the ranger districts and migrated upwards so that all the ranger districts have is a spreadsheet with a number of days on it to spend in projects. And so an agency that served the public prior to that by moving funds around to meet local need all of a sudden became a 1 or 2 year process to get something done because there was no flexibility, so to speak, at the field level to address emerging issues. That in itself added a lot of time to processes, and that's one of the things I think that the public, well, I know the public doesn't know that about the budget process.
Right.
But that's the one thing that decoupled the local folks from being able to get the agency to do things they thought were important.
Well, and along with that, you had, because that was about that same time, right, when if you had a fire, you had to actually calculate the cost of the public land timber that was that was lost in the fire.
Yeah, we had to do that until about, my memory's fading a little bit, but around 1999 is when the total fire cost, including the resource loss, remained part of the reporting process. It's no longer there.
So really, all the accountability, I guess.
That's what it is.
Because that really is the bottom line is the accountability was on the ground. It was local. And the people in that area could actually probably affect it.
Yeah, and the agency was, prior to 2000, was largely decentralized, with decentralized decision making, and that's what its strength was.
And so if you had a bad guy at the helm in your area, it didn't take down the whole thing.
No, you just moved him.
You just got rid of that guy.
Yeah, and that was frequent. I mean,
I'm sure
the ranger was kind of like a political appointee, served at the will of whoever, and they were moved all over the place, for whatever activity that wasn't according to Hoyle.
Yeah, it's like, that's not good.
Yeah.
Off he goes.
All of a sudden, you're not in Fort Jones anymore. You're in San Francisco in the regional office.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're going to get you away from the public because you're making everybody angry.
Yeah.
And the resource base at that time then funded the schools and...
Yeah, well, that actually, the high point for like Siskiyou County was 1988, I believe, about $8.5 million in deposits to roads and schools in that county.
And how was that for folks who don't follow this kind of thing? How was that generated?
It was generated off a percentage of the receipts off of the timber that was sold.
Okay, yeah, so if your county was largely forest land, because now that's a huge impediment.
Right.
Counties like Trinity and Siskiyou and a lot of these places that are largely public land, now there's no benefit to them.
It's
just a resource they don't get.
It's a burden.
Yeah.
It's both a tax burden, it's a burden on whether or not you could have a strong economy in the future. Because one thing you have to remember is that the Clinton administration, because of the Northwest Forest Plan, put something in place, payments to states, which was a payment in lieu of the timber harvest at a historic level. And from working with Congress that's been a struggle to keep getting that reauthorized. Well, that's set on those receipts that were taken in 1988, but it continues to go downward. And the whole
and now they think it's like, now they treat it like it's welfare.
Right.
Now we're doling out money to these guys because we're really nice now.
It was to replace the collapse of the industry under the Northwest Forest Plan in 1993. And, it was only to be there for a 10-year period because after 10 years everything was going to be nirvana again, and it continues to go downhill. But the one thing I want to say most about that, though, is that you can give something out in a welfare payment, but it doesn't have a multiplicative effect in the economy.
Right.
You know, it goes to a few teachers and a few workers at the county level. But if you had the actual receipts generating those dollars in the timber industry like it were before, then you have a 15 times multiplier.
Because you had real people working in the woods
and
hauling the...
And that whole piece is missing.
Which is why it feels like all the rural counties are just poor.
Which is why Siskiyou County used to be one of the richest counties in the state of California, and now it's third from the bottom.
Wow. And so unnecessary because the resource is there, and actually it's...
Actually, there's...
I mean, what do you have?
We have more trees now than when the agency first was put into practice.
So that whole idea that we've cut all the trees down...
No, the research I've been doing just in Siskiyou Mountains, like I said, from the with the Sugar Creek research I've been doing, we're four times the wood fiber density per acre than we were in 1930.
Wow. So if we cut a few of them, we'd be all right.
I don't think you'd miss them.
Yeah, I think we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But burning them up is so much more fun.
Yeah.
No. We have NEPA questions, the National Environmental Policy Act questions in here, and... We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, folks. We just have a lot. So you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
It took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them.
That's the Park Service, yeah.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, so we have a whole nother hour with you, but in this last 4 minutes, give us some numbers on the forest in your area, just from what's happened since they've stopped cutting and gone into this weird preservation thing.
Well, I can tell you the biological potential of the Klamath National Forest is about 600 million board feet a year. And that's
not cutting the whole forest down.
That's what's grown every year on that forest outside of wilderness designation. That is the net volume growth. The gross is 800 and some. So that would include the occasional bug infestation, the trees just dying because of old age, that kind of thing. So in the heyday, so to speak, in the 80s, the Klamath National Forest was producing on the market about 200 to 250 million board feet annually. That was departure. You know, it was a little too strong because you have to understand that not everything in growth goes directly into growth. You know, some of
sure.
it, yeah, there's tree competition, those kinds of things that slow things down. So, but certainly anything around 150 would certainly be sustained on that landscape. Today, the Klamath struggles. The Northwest Forest Plan says it should be producing 55 million board feet a year.
I'm frightened to ask, what's it producing?
It struggles to get out 20.
Wow.
20 million.
And 55 sounds kind of low to me.
55 is so low that, it's barely enough to keep an industry alive.
Right, right. That's not enough to even go in there. And
so what's that do to the water?
Well, interesting enough, if you want to check that out, look at the research that Dr. Roger Bales is doing in the Sierra Nevada with the Sierra Nevada Consortium and the research folks down there. I'm also working with Roger Bales in Siskiyou County in the Sugar Creek Project. And you can find that report on Northern California Resource Center webpage. And there's a link to the Sugar Creek Project there.
Nice. I'll link that on the website.
Yeah. What we see is twofold with forest densities. One, we chose to model forest water yields from 1930 to present, and then projecting into the future with the current management that's occurring. Now, this study occurs both on private and public lands. So private lands are a little different. They're highly managed, but they're also a little dysfunctional as well. We've seen since 1930 about four times the density of wood that's been there historically, and that's cessation of fire from both Native American burning and settler grazing burning, as well as lack of harvest, and a shift from ponderous pine that was predominantly in the landscape that doesn't use a whole lot of water to true fir.
And is this private land you're talking about?
Both in the public and the private. It's more prevalent on the public land. Higher densities, higher tree densities.
And that's the dysfunctional part you're talking
about?
Well,
the dysfunctional part is that it leads to large fire behavior because there aren't any holes in it like historically there were.
Like meadows?
Yeah, like meadows. And actually, Eric Knapp's research in the Sierra says 25% of the landscape was in early seral across that
we're
going
to do more of this when we come back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.